All right, today is Monday, January 29th, 2018, and it's Monday morning. A big hello to my students in front and a big hello to the many listening. I don't know if you heard yesterday's shiur, but before I just repeat a word on the shiur, I just want to mention that on this question I raised with Rabbi Aaron Cutler and Chabad, I was now sent a lot of documents. And the question is a real question. It seems, I can't judge, I didn't do thorough research. This awaits someone to do a doctorate, a fallout from Effie, from my original work on Rabbi Silver, and then Effie Zurab's work on Van Hatzala. But it seems very real that there were terrible complaints about Baron Cutler, that money came through, and people saw, they actually saw the handwriting to distribute to the Litvish students, the Mir, but not to Chabadnikim. And there was a Din Torah, according to these documents, there was a Din Torah after the Shoah. Rabbi Kotler took Rabbi Ashkenazi, who was the Rav of the area, and he was a Chabadnik, took him to Din Torah, why he took off money and did give it to Chabadnikim despite the orders. And the Din Torah reached a very simple conclusion that Rav Ashkenazi risked his life in what he did. Therefore, he was entitled to a certain percentage. And that's the percentage he gave to Chabad. That's according to these documents. The question here that haunts me and should haunt every thinking Jew is, why was Rav Aaron so opposed to Chabad? And if we can solve that problem, we'll begin to understand Rav Shach, because both Rav Shach and Rav Aaron, Rav Shach was a Talmud Chaver, or a Talmud, maybe a Talmud Chaver of Rav Aaron Cutler. They're both Kletzka. And this is a very real reason. So I throw it out, and if someone will undertake to really do the research, and this requires someone who understands, goes to graduate school, understands how to do research and how you can interpret documents, I'll be happy to put him in touch with people who can advise him and give him information. But the question hangs fire. Now, yesterday, I consider yesterday perhaps the most important shiur I've given in years. I have to say that Rabbi Rubin was correct, and the document I quoted does appear in Natty Helfgott's collection, Community, Covenant, and Commitment, Selected Letters and Communications. Beginning on page 227, you have the letter to Rebbetzin Miriam Shiloh. However, the letter appears, a nice English translation, as Rabbi Rubin said, I didn't have to break my teeth translating it. It's right there. And there's no commentary on the letter whatsoever. It might even be, you know, it all comes back to me now, that I gave this letter to Natty Helfgott. I remember he contacted me and I gave him a number of letters in my possession. I'm actually positive I gave it to him. And I engendered the publication of this letter. Some of the other letters I gave him, very interestingly, were personal letters from the Rav to me. And they did not publish them because they felt they were personal. And the Lichtenstein's attitude was essentially Tova, that telling Natty that certain letters are not lahansiach, it's not l'dore dorat. It's written under certain circumstances. I don't know if I agree with them, because one of the letters to me was very important not to get involved in machloikis. And that letter, Heshi Shechter, Rabbi Shechter quotes it, he doesn't give the details. The letter was to me, and I can tell you the story. It's not important now. But I didn't agree that they didn't publish. That letter was particularly important. So what if it had to do with certain circumstances? But the comment on not getting involved in machlekes, that nothing good comes out of it, that is a universal comment, way beyond the unique circumstances. The other letter, as a Talmud of the Rav on our relationship, that letter too they didn't publish, which I don't understand why. Maybe because I published it in my work, the Rav. All right, let it be. But this letter, they did publish without comment. And if when you'll hear the shiur, you'll understand what I'm talking about. That I took the last paragraph and I opened up the Rav's mind, and ultimately the Lubavitcher Rebbe's mind. And it's a quagmire. It haunts us until today. What are the Rabbanim supposed to do? Do you come in Aliyah? Don't you come in Aliyah? Do you leave the people behind? I admit, my point of view is everyone has to come in Aliyah. We have to do what the Torah requires. We can't make Cheshbon. Aliyah is a mitzvah, the Ramban, a mitzvah, the Oraita. In our generation, after the Holocaust, look what's going on in Poland today. In our generation, Englanu mitzvah, yote gedola me'aliyah. And some of us got it from the Torah. Charlie got it from Professor Katzir. But we all reached the same conclusion. But the question, what do you do with the Jews left in the Gola? And this is where I joined with the Jewish Agency, what was the Torah Culture Department, the Strauss Hamiel. We can send Rabbanim, we can send Mahanchim all over the world, and we can, and it would be even more influence, because these people are not under the pressure of the local Balabatim. They are free, lahadir Torah, lahadir in the full sense of the word. And you don't stay for more than, I would say, 5 years. 3 years is too little. It takes a year to adjust, a year to perform, a year to worry what I'll do when I come back. But this is my opinion. There are other opinions out there. I may be right, I may be wrong. The Chabadnikim go, they stay forever. And that's to their advantage. In the sense, they become part and parcel of the community. If you recall, I showed you an article comparing Bnei Akiva Shluchim to Chabad Shluchim, and there's nothing to compare. Because the Bnei Akiva kid comes, as I would imagine, I look at my own grandchildren. So they speak English, fine, you send them to a community to learn the mentality. By the time you learn it, you're ready to go back to Israel. A Chabadnik goes, and he becomes part and parcel of the community, the food, the drink. We don't realize, we take this for granted. But all this, when they make a Kabbalah panim, when they make an affair, so Bnei Akiva kid is doing, bringing all the food imports from Israel. The Chabadnikim is giving them local food that they can appreciate, that's part of their culture. It's a delicate issue. But to me, that paragraph, it's really, I say, sad that it appears in the volume, but it doesn't really analyze anything. Makom hinichalov. I'm quoting the Gemara in Chulin now. Daf Zayin Amud Aleph. Makom hinichalov. Otav didgader ba. That the Ribbono Shel Olam left me a little insight that I could say something that I don't believe has ever been said before. Okay, so that was the heart of yesterday's Shia. Then we're getting involved with the Rav of Melamed, and I want to take apart the Rav. I want to take apart his relationship with his children. I want to discuss it. I don't know if I'll ever touch this again. I want to discuss it honestly and give you an interesting picture. Of course, it's a personal picture, subjective, but there are overtones of someone with scholarship and a doctorate, and I try to be as intellectually honest as I can. The story ended off the class with yesterday with Chaim Gold. A very moving story, a story that I write about in Washington, a story that people quote me on, and it happened to me, and to repeat it very quickly, Chaim Gold had studied in Israel. He was a young kid, big yichis, Rav Zev Gold is his grandfather, and his father was the Rav, the first rabbi of a major community today, Englewood, New Jersey. Then it was just beginning, and Chaim Gold comes back to America. His mother brought him back. His father is dead. Grandfather is dead. And he comes to Yeshiva and Yeshiva College, Yeshiva University. We're classmates. We're maybe he's a year or two younger than I am. To me, it was magnificent to touch a student who studied in Yerushalayim. And the first year, he goes to college. The second year, I notice when I'm going up to college, he's in the Beis Medrash. So I ask him, Chaim, how come you're not going to college? And he says, no, it's a waste of time. Why do I need college? And I was a yenta. I apologize. I go to the Rav and I say, Rebbe, Chaim Gold is not going to college this year. He's sitting in the Beis Medrash. The Rav says, bring him in to me. I go into the Beis Medrash and I bring in Chaim. And The conversation, I repeat it word by word. The Rebbe, what's this that Anu tells me you're not going to college? And the Rebbe says to Chaim, I don't know what Chazal mean when they said in Pirkei Avot, Yofe Kamatorim Derech Eretz, but Ein Zach Vesich. Today, Derech Eretz means going to college. So, you remember the end of the story, Chaim says, but Rebbe, it's late, registration is over, I'll take care of it. You go upstairs. You have to go up to the third or fourth floor, and the Rebbe says to me, who do I have to speak to? I say, Professor Silverman, Morris Silverman. He's the registrar, Zichrono Livracha, nice guy. So we run to Rabbi Belkin's office, and Mrs. Atlas, who was Rabbi Belkin's girl, Friday says, Rabbi Soloveitchik, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? Can you get me Morris Silverman on the phone? Of course, of course. And a minute later, the Rebbe says, Professor Silverman, this is Yosef Soloveitchik speaking. And he tells him, a kid is coming up, Chaim Gold, please take care of him. About a half hour later, Chaim comes down, and he says to me, wow, they were so nice to me. They didn't even charge me for late registration. But he says, it's funny. Professor Silverman told me twice, be sure to tell Rabbi Soloveitchik what I did for you. All right, P.S. Chaim later graduates college, and it was very moving. Rabbi Hertz went home last night. He was sitting here. He's the rabbi in Kew Gardens Hills, in Hillcrest, excuse me, at Utopia Parkway Jewish Center. And he said Chaim was his teacher in Manhattan Day School, MDS. He taught there for over 50 years. He's retired today. He's not a youngster. Even though I feel young, I have to admit we're not youngsters. Okay. Now, let me go a drop further. I spoke about, again, Miriam Shiloh, and I gave the source. You'll hear it. You'll pick it up on the tape. Now, what do you see from this story? And I'm more convinced that I'm absolutely right than ever. What do you see from this story? Take the words of the Rav. I don't know what Derech Eretz means, but Mizman Hazet means college. And this, to me, the Rav, the college, the university, was a result of living in the Western world. I don't believe he had the same gestalt as Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. And I mentioned to you, I once said this in Los Angeles. Oh, and the rabbi got so upset with me, and the next week he gave a special talk to refute me. And I later heard the talk, and it simply turned Rav Soloveitchik into Rav Hirsch. I believe there is a big difference between them. Now, when we started collecting tapes of the Rav and seeking and searching, and this is a story that cannot be revealed yet in its entirety, but it's a major story that will have a tremendous impact, in my humble opinion, on Torah civilization. Well, one of the talks we came up with was a talk, and if I just made a recording telling the story, I can be released in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So telling the story, I mentioned that I'm going with this person who put a fortune of money into this project, and his driver, we're driving to the end of the world. It was someplace in Yonkers near the Hudson River, and you're going down, down, down. I thought we were going to fall into the river. So what were we picking up there? This individual worked for YUCSD, Community Service Division. I don't know if he's still alive. I lost track of him. But he was a well-known name in the 50s into the 60s. And he had recordings of the Rav. I would say this is the Rav in his prime achievement time, when he was at the apex of his strength and health. And one of the recordings was a talk the Rav gave to the rabbinic alumni of Yeshiva University, March 1st, 1956. Many decades ago, I translated this talk word by word from the Yiddish into English, and I redid it right in the Kollel, maybe 30, 30, 40 years ago. Very powerful talk. And I want to quote to you just part of the talk, because I feel it sustains and it complements my point of view on the Rav. And I agree, if you're going to challenge me from Ish Halacha, in Ish Halacha, the Rav sounds much more Hirschian than he does in this talk. I agree. But on the other hand, Ish halacha, whenever the Rav got involved in philosophy, if you're aware what's going on today with all the philosophers dealing with the Rav, they struggle to find a consistent trend of thought in the Rav. A volume just appeared, articles have appeared, the Rav contradicts himself. If you understand Rakefet's point of view, there's no problem. In Shas and Paiskim, the Rav never contradicted himself. That was the heart, that was the basis. And if he contradicted himself, you could call him to order. And he had to justify his position. But when it comes to philosophy, there I always felt it wasn't that the Rav was using philosophy to engender a philosophical system, but he was using philosophy to back up Shas and Paiskim and Jewish thinking and Jewish living and Jewish thought. And if he could take something philosophical, for instance, you take the Cantonian principles, the thesis, the antithesis, the synthesis, the Hegelian dialectics, as it's called, that was fabulous. He used it, lahagdir Torah lahadira. But to say he was engendering an entire philosophic system, there I would raise a question mark. And this is why all the philosophers struggle to put the Rav together, that his philosophic system should be constant. Shas and Paiskim and his Torah gestalt, that is constant. Everything else was auxiliary, secondary, supplementary to the heart of the Rav. This is my take on the Rav, and I stand on it. I admit there are other people who think differently out there, but I stand on my point of view. And I quote the Rav now in Yiddish, but I quote my English translation. I have heard criticisms against the yeshiva that we have not yet achieved the proper synthesis between Torah study and secular endeavor, between fear of God and worldliness. We have not achieved what the German Orthodox Jews call Torah with Derech Eretz. Avot Perek Mishnah. Claim, here's the heart of the Rav. I claim that the true greatness of the yeshiva is that it does not have this synthesis. The truth is that there is no synthesis in the world. If there is a contradiction between Torah and secular endeavor, then synthesis is not possible. If there is a thesis and antithesis, then no synthesis is possible. In general, a synthesis is very superficial. It is apologetic. It imitates others. And the individual loses his uniqueness. Listen to this sentence. In synthesis, no one succeeds. Even our great teacher, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, did not succeed at his attempts at synthesis. What is the Rav saying here? See, this he's in the heart of the issue. Tell me, how many of you study Mishneh Torah? I learned a Daf Gemara. Without a Rambam, it's not a Daf Gemara. At times, the Rav used the Rambam to touch up the Gemara. You understand the Girsa and the Rambam, the way the Rambam formulates it, opens your eyes how to understand the Gemara. If you're a Chabadnik, the Chabadnik came every 3 years. Make a siyum in the Rambam. The Rebbe introduced that. You know, the joke going around is they can tell who you are by the siyum you make. If you make a siyum in Rambam, you're a Chabadnik. If you make a siyum in Yerushalmi, you're a Gerach Chassid. If you make a siyum in Shas, oh, das heißt a Litvak. You understand? So, we all learn Mishneh Torah. Tell me, how many of you have learned Moreh Nevuchim? Moreh Nevuchim, the story is told that Reb Moshe Soloveitchik was curious to see what the Moreh Nevuchim was about, and Reb Chaim came over and closed the Moreh Nevuchim, said, that's for people who have doubts, who are Navuch. You have a father, you have a grandfather, we have no doubts, you don't need the Moreh Nevuchim. Now you start with the Moreh Nevuchim, you can find contradictions. I'll give you the biggest contradiction of all, that endless ink has been spilled on this issue. Tell me, part of Shas, Moed, we live, Nizikin, we live, Nashim, we live. What about Kodshim? What about Taharat? But let's go back to Kodshim, Karbanot. Nu, B'yomot HaMashiach, will we have Karbanot? Think about it. The conservatives got rid of it many years ago. In their Musaf davening, they didn't abolish Musaf. The Reform abolished Musaf. They have no problem. Conservatives didn't abolish Musaf, but Karbanot, modern mind, it's frightening. And what did they say? Anyone opened the Silverman Siddur? V'sham hikrivu lefanecha, past tense. Anachno say v'nakriv lefanecha, they say hikrivu. You can check it out, past tense. The Moreh Nevuchim speaks about Karbanot. Nu, does anyone study Moreh Nevuchim? Moreh Nevuchim, I studied in graduate school. I had the Moreh Nevuchim, Kuzari. I have one son-in-law who knows the Sfarim by heart, word by word. But Moreh Nevuchim, he talks about Karbanot as a compromise with pagan practice. That since the Jews were influenced by their stay in Egypt, and this is the way the pagans worshipped the Ribbono Shel Olam, so God came along and introduced Karbanot, that it should on one hand enable them to do what they understood, to bring sacrifice, to bring animals, to bring the sakim, to bring the yayin, the menachot. But on the other hand, it elevated it on a very high level, taking out the idol worship out of it. So if you take the Moreh Nevuchim to its logical conclusion, it means la'atid lavo, we don't need sacrifice. We're on a higher level today. Who needs Karbanot? We're on a higher level. So you see right there, and this is a well-known question, so many people have written about it, devoted their pens to it, but the Rav here is saying, even the Rambam didn't succeed in his synthesis. On one hand you have Mishneh Torah, on the other hand you have Moreh Nevuchim. And there never was a successful synthesis between the two. Now, I want to share a thought with you too, and tell one story. One thought out of the rabbinate. I was asked this question in the 60s, many, many years ago. And I gave a very simple answer. The Mishneh Torah is Aaron, at that time Rothkopf, teaching in Yeshivas Reb Tzvi Chanan. There you teach the truth. The Moreh Nevuchim is Aaron Rothkopf in the rabbinate trying to build an Orthodox shul in Maplewood, South Orange. Okay? That's the way I would approach it. I think it's a very honest answer, but it supports the Rav's thesis. It is harmonious coexistence, in my words. It is not a synthesis. That's one point. The story out of Israel is a true story, very fascinating. At one time, everything was much more primitive, and the radio, there was a lot of English radio after the Six-Day War. I don't believe, is there any English on the radio today? I don't know. But after the Six-Day War, there were actually, every day there was news in English, and there was Friday, I believe it was, or before Yom Tov. Literally, they had an hour or two in English on one of the prime radio stations. So they had a person who was a South African. He was in charge of the English programming. So one time he contacts me. This has to be in the 70s. But he contacts me. They want to do a program on Tisha B'Av, and they've asked me to represent the Orthodox point of view. All right, fine. So I come down to the radio station, and I have to tell you, I met there a graduate of Lo Aleinu, a mere Lakewood graduate. He's no longer, he died young. I don't want to mention his name, but it's no secret. has the name actually of someone on the Gris faculty, the exact same name. So I never saw such hatred for Torah as this person had. His wife did not. There was another case I know where the woman, they claim, committed suicide. She married a yeshivish guy, and look what happened. She didn't commit suicide, but she divorced him, and he remarried afterwards, and he came with a piece of paper, question after question against Torah. Well, you're wondering what type of questions? So I'll give you a simple example. Lo techayeh kol neshama. How could the Torah write this? I answered him. I spoke in terms, if they want to make peace, there's one sheet of Rishonim that you can make peace even with the Shivamamin. And then I mentioned after Hitler, I'm not so troubled by this very question. But then he threw at me, how can you mourn on Tisha B'av Churban Bayit for Karbanot and Beit HaMikdash? How can a modern man even consider this normative religious behavior? So I quoted the Ramban. The Ramban in his Hakdama to Sefer Vayikra gives a whole description of Karbanot, and it says something very, very important that we really can't understand it until we live it. When you live it and you feel the whole environment and the whole Beis HaMikdash and the sanctity and the Kohanim and the Leviim and the Shira, and so then you have a different attitude. But I said to him, one thing I'm certain of, if we had Karbanah today, we would be so much safer and so much less Akmas Nefesh in mourning. And he looks at me, and I say, very simple, if people saw Karbanot, the way they sacrifice a living animal is then on the altar, the flames consume him, they would be a lot more careful when they drive. You don't know what an impression that sentence made. A lot more careful when they drive. Wherever I walked in Yerushalayim, people accosted me. Oh, Yashakayach, Yashakayach. You know how many people have been killed by cars? You know how many Rabbanim have been killed by cars? Do you know how many dynasties were wiped out by cars? Are you aware that the person who should have been the Gerer Rebbe today was a Gaon Adir, was killed by a bus on Rehov Malchei Yisrael? Are you aware that the Sach Tshuva Rebbe was killed in a car accident after visiting someone in the hospital in the center of the country? Are you aware that Hanukkah, who can forget it, Rav Kook of Rehovot with two of his children, his wife, I don't recall the entire tragedy, Shem Yerachem, what was wiped out in one car accident. Here, you have upstairs, what's the name of the Lakewood fellow who was down south, wrote so many sfarim, had so much hatzlacha, Pinchas, Rav Pinchas, his daughter-in-law works out, how was he died young, killed in a car accident. Halavai we had Karbanot, and you can imagine, mother was a Weinberg, from that family, wow. So you can go one by one. Reb David Pinchas, I think his name. So many svarim, so brilliant, so successful. Everyone loved him. Oh, if we saw Karbanot, we'd be a lot more careful when we drive. As I can tell you from last Friday, check when you're ready to move after you stop. If you think you're in drive, check for sure you're not in reverse. You follow me? If we saw Karbanot, boy, would we be different. But my point is very simple, and the Rav is making it, not me. I'm just trying to make the point come to life, that we don't have a synthesis. There is a contradiction. This is the Mishneh Torah. This is the Moreh Nevuchim. And the Ravs, we have to study both of them. The Rav knew both of them inside out. But there was never a synthesis. It was harmonious coexistence. The thesis and the antithesis. And then he goes into what yeshiva is all about. He says the greatness of the yeshiva, meaning yeshiva university, is that it is a real yeshiva, and on the second level, a proper academic institution. Both divisions function without synthesis and compromise. And the Rav repeats this and feels very strongly. The uniqueness of the yeshiva is another reason why I am loyal to this institution. It is a reflection of my own thinking and commitment. And this is the Rav. This reflects in so many different policy issues that came up. And here on this level, my cousin Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Belkin, and of course the Rav were in total conformity. Remember I told you the story of the mythology, the Greek mythology. So every few years this would happen. A group of kids would organize, go to the Rav. Rebbe, they're teaching Avodah Zarah in the yeshiva, idol worship. They're teaching Ritzicha in the yeshiva. They're teaching sexual crimes, Greek mythology. You saw that. So the Rav was not impressed. He would say to them, if you want to understand Western civilization, you have to understand Greek mythology. And the truth is, we could never understand Western civilization without Greek mythology. What is Greek mythology all about? It shows you how decrepit and degenerate and sinful the gods were. No, if the gods can be sinful, why not human beings? Now take a look at Western civilization. Look at the presidents of the United States. Go on, take a look. Kennedy, what went on, I eulogized him. We thought he was the Tzadik Hadar. It turned out the Secret Service would tell him when Jacqueline was coming home so he'd get rid of the women who were playing around with him in the White House. It's frightening. Take a look at Clinton, President of the United States. Roosevelt died in the hands of his mistress. It's unbelievable. And right? No, you can go on and on and on. And murder, who knows, with Marilyn Monroe, with all these stories, rumors are true. God have mercy, what we're talking about. And you see now all the gossip with the president, Ribbono Shel Olam. Oh, but if you know Greek mythology, this is Western civilization. If the gods can live like that, why not ordinary mortals? Where are we different? And I have to tell you, the Rav, and this reflects, you see, right down the line, Yeshiva University was often criticized by students. Why don't they run courses showing us the relationship between science and Torah? There never was such a course in Yeshiva. Torah was Torah, and science was science. And how you dealt with it afterwards, that was up to you. The Rav said time and again, when we were growing up, maybe Charlie's generation too, you can either confirm what I'm saying or you're beyond it. The biggest question was the age of the world. Do you remember that question? The age of the world, the shocking question. All right? The Rav said, never bothered him. He said, as a Jew, I believe this, and science says something else. So what? And you can answer very simply. Oh, I remember Reb Shmuel Soloveitchik, we once were discussing with the Rav's younger brother, 2 years younger, number two in the five Soloveitchik children. So Reb Shmuel said, when man was created, how old was he? You'd look at him, you'd say he's an adult, he's 21, he's big, he speaks, he's really 2 minutes old. So you see the whole process of creation, when you look into the ground and you check everything, it shows billions of years. In reality, it can be, but there was never a contradiction. You can live with both of them. We were never overwhelmed. And this was the Rav, this was Yeshiva, and it continues. It continues until today. As far as I know, in Yeshiva College, there is no censorship. In Stern College, there is no censorship. All the courses are available. You can study arts, you can study music, you can study literature. Some of the literature really is sickening and overly sexual, and it's beyond words what you can get involved with. But this is life. You have to be prepared. See, this is a Hirshian approach. Would never tolerate it. A Hirshian approach to Torah and Derech Eretz blending into one. In the Hirshian Reali School, which is basically a high school in Frankfurt, all the teachers had to be either Shomer Shabbos Jews or practicing Christians. They would never allow an atheist to teach in the reality school. It was a different approach altogether. And here in this talk to the YU alumni, the Rav is laying out his principles, stressing why he loves the yeshiva. Now, this is a crucial sentence, and it's the Rav's words. I only translate it. In this concept, our yeshiva is unique. It is not like other yeshiva. We have a yeshiva, and because the times demand that we also have the universities, these two divisions will not be synthesized. They will remain two institutions. It may be like a man with two heads, but it is better to have two heads than not to have one at all. And that sentence, the audience, of course, breaks into laughter, but it's a very powerful sentence. And in that talk, I can tell you the Rav went after the Brooklyn yeshiva that are always criticizing the yeshiva. And, you know, this is the 50s. And the Rav said, I'd like to know when the faculty is paid, how many weeks they have to wait for their salary, how the yeshiva exists and the administration is over in Issa the Oraita of Lo Talim Pulat Sakhir, of paying the worker on time. And there the Rav turns to Rav Shmuel Belkin and he says, we owe a great gratitude of thanks to Rabbi Belkin, he says. From the time he became president, there was never one instance where the yeshiva did not pay its faculty on time. And again, it's hard for you to conceive of this, what the world was like in the 20s, into the 30s, into the 40s, and the attitude was towards faculty in a yeshiva, you're lucky you have a job. Don't complain that money is backed up and backed up till we pay you. And many times they didn't get their full salary. Vic knows what I'm talking about. They had a compromise on what they were finally paid. And Rav Shmuel Belkin, you have to give credit. Ultimately, it creates tremendous physical, emotional problems for him. By the 1960s, the burden of the yeshiva, the drive to raise funds, you see the impact it has on Rav Shmuel Belkin. And it's sad, because Chassidic Rebbeim somehow never have this problem. If the Lubavitcher Rebbe wants to start a project, do a project, the money within minutes is on the table. It's amazing. You go Satmar, and I don't consider them good Jews, but that's a different story. But the Satmar Ruv, whether you're talking about the one in Williamsburg, the one upstate, the money is on the table. Look at Gare, look at Bells. Gare runs a weekend. I think you have to put up $25,000 minimum. Maybe it went up. I remember a friend of mine had a mechutin who had gestampt from Gerich Chassidim, very successful medical doctors. Mechutin, these are very elegant people. And his mechutin got hold of my good friend, who's not a poor man. You have to spend the Shabbos with the Rebbe. I think it was in Italy. They had a retreat, and everyone there was a minimum $25,000 on the table. Spend the Shabbos with the Rebbe. Today it's probably more, and today I think it's in Eretz Yisrael. I think already the Rebbe doesn't leave Eretz Yisrael. So, all right, this was the Rebbe, this was the yeshiva, and very, very important talk. Now, let's go one step further. Something else about the Rav as a Rebbe. You can start to understand who my mentor was and many of my attitudes as a Rebbe over the many decades I've been privileged to teach Torah. But there's no question, harmonious coexistence, that was the Rav. He was totally at home in America. More than being totally at home in America, Dr. Tova Lichtenstein used the word, my father was a Brahmin. And I looked it up in the international dictionary. A Brahmin, of course, is a high caste in India. But it means specifically someone that believed New England was the seat of Western culture. The high point of the modern world was to be found in New England, particularly in the greater Boston area, all the universities, all the hospitals, and the Rav was absolutely, totally caught up with this concept. His own children all went to the top universities in the Boston area. Now, something happened in class. Again, it's a small incident, but my memory relives it. And again, I've been quoted on this 1,000 times over. People have called me to check. And that raises the whole issue of Thanksgiving Day. Are we allowed to celebrate Thanksgiving Day? And you all know in the Reb Moshe Feinstein, they came out. Again, these volumes that come out after the master is dead, it's questionable how much you can be samach on them. You have to always differentiate what the master published during his lifetime and what is published posthumously. For obvious reasons, you have to question it. But one of the volumes that came out right after Reb Moshe died, endless, endless pages. Can you celebrate Thanksgiving? And can't you celebrate? And Reb Moshe is negative. And people from the family, from the earlier generation, tell me not to be samach on what's published, and there's nothing wrong with celebrating Thanksgiving Day. But all I can tell you is, B'didi Havayov, then it was very simple. The Rav gave shir Tuesday, Wednesday. He flew in on Tuesday. Originally, he drove in. The Rebbetzin drove in. I still remember the black Dodge parked in front of the yeshiva on Amsterdam Avenue, and that was the Rav's car. Later, the Rebbetzin generally did not come with him, and he flew already. There was a shuttle. You could come to the airport at any time in Boston, and as the planes filled, they shuttled off to New York. So he would. Do you remember it? I don't remember what airline, but it doesn't exist today. There's no such thing as a shuttle today. It's a different world then. They didn't have this. They didn't have to worry about Arabs blowing up planes today. What we go through, it's beyond comprehension. You can't take a bottle of water. I told you I had this sealed bottle, and I come. They say you got to spill it out. I say I can keep the bottle. Yeah, you can keep. Thank God I can keep the bottle. I had to spill it out. So generally the Rav came in Tuesday and he flew back Wednesday afternoon. This week he had a wedding in Boston Tuesday night. Balabas, he had to be there. So he came in Wednesday and he was going to fly back Thursday. Wednesday when Shir ended, I can just see Rebbe looking at his watch. Tomorrow we'll have to make shears, has to be early. And he says, 9:30. 9:30, is that good? You'll be here? And, you know, everyone says, okay, Rebbe, you say 9:30. She was generally 10, 9:30, maybe 9. But I was a chutzpan, you know, by this time already I was afraid of the Rav, but I wasn't that afraid. I said, Rebbe, why so early? And the Rav knew who he was dealing with. He turns to me and he breaks into a big smile. Anu, don't you know what tomorrow is? Thanksgiving Day. And I promised my wife we have to be at my sister's Thanksgiving dinner by 2 o'clock. You follow? So he had to allow time for the plane to land and whoever was picking him up, take him to his sister. It was probably Shulamit Meiselman, I would imagine. Could be Ann Gerber, but I would imagine Shulamit Meiselman. And the whole class breaks into laughter. But what do you see from that story? That the Rav was totally at home in the American context. Thanksgiving Day to him was not even a shaila. It didn't get off the floor. What's wrong with Thanksgiving Day? It's emulating Sukkot. Sukkot, we thank God as Jews. And Thanksgiving Day, we thank God as the Toshav in the United States. And the Rav had a lot to be thankful for. You all know the story. He would tell time and again. And I will stand on my guess. The Rav said, we was once talking about the efficacy of prayer, how important and powerful prayer is. And the Rebbe said, but not every time does God answer you. And the fact that he doesn't answer you at times can be a big bracha. And the Rebbe said, you have no idea. When I was getting married, there was a position I desperately wanted. And I prayed and I pleaded with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And had I been elected to that position, I would not be here. My wife would not be here. My children would not be here. Quote, end quote. Rebbe Heschel quotes this in one of his svarim. The Rebbe didn't mention the position. Rakef, it's educated guess. Anyone want to guess? It's very simple. His uncle, Rebbe Menachem Karakovsky, the Avodat HaMelech, was a member of the Beit Din in Vilna. Vilna never had in modern times a chief rabbi. Why didn't Vilna not have a chief rabbi? Because during the time of the Gaon, there was a big fight. The chief of the Gaon had no official role, Labriot in Vilna. The Gaon sat and learned. He was given a stipend by the community. They all knew who the Gaon was. He just sat in his corner and learned. He didn't mix into any of the local Vilna politics. When the Av Beit Din, the chief rabbi, died, I believe his name was Reb Shmuel, there was a big machloket, and they got the Balabatim got so tired of the machloket that they vowed and ruled there would never be a chief rabbi again, only a Beit Din. So in modern times, there was a Beit Din. You know some of the names, Reb Chaim Moshe Grishinsky, Reb Meir Bassin, Reb Gustman's father-in-law, Reb Menachem Karak, and each member of the Beit Din had an added responsibility. One was in charge of Kashrut, one was in charge of Gittin. So Reb Menachem Karakovsky was the town spokesman. He was the Magid Meisharim. When there was an official event, a funeral, a wedding, the king came to visit, the local governor came to visit, the chief of police came to visit. So Reb Menachem Karakovsky was the Magid Meisharim, and he was quite well beyond Torah. He had a scientific approach in addition to a Balashiner approach. You all know his Avodat HaMelech was very unique. I've spoken about it. He knew languages. So he was excellent as a member of the Beit Din and as the public Magid Meisharim of the community. He died 29-30. It's exactly when the Rav is courting Tanya. Exactly when the Rebbe's come back to Vilna, exactly when he was ready to marry, he's looking for a position. What could have been more matim, mepasik, more fitting for the Rav than to be a member of the Vilna Beit Din? And they didn't take him. And I'm only guessing. The Rav never mentioned the community, but my scholarship of that period leads to this very potent and yet simple conclusion. Vilna. So Morty, you're wondering why they didn't take him? So I'll reveal secrets now. They didn't take him because they were choishish who he is. He already was in Berlin. He was getting a doctorate in Berlin. You're talking Reb Chaim Moshe Grishinsky. On one hand, he loved the Rav. On the other hand, they were frightened. They were frightened. The Rav's biggest supporter was Reb Avram Dovber Kahane Shapira Vick. You know who that was? That was the Kovna Rav. And Reb Avram Dovber Kahane Shapira was accused of being a maskil. You follow? And he supported the Rav. He gave the Rav smicha. But, I once did a monograph. It appears in the Kafir Aaron Chelek Aleph. I did a monograph on the Kovna Rav. I have a letter they later published. He worked, he was a Telja, and he worked for Feldheim. He ran the store. He wrote a letter. How do you publish about the Kovna Rav? He was an apikoyrish. He was a maskil. He was in favor of general education. So you see from that letter why the Kovna Rav loved the Rav. And you can understand why in Vilna, Reb Chaim Moshe Grishinsky and that element was not happy to have him on the Beit Din. And that saved his life. I can tell you something else. I have my possession. When that article came out in the Kovner Rav, so the Kovner Rav's family was wiped out during the Holocaust. The Kovner Rav died. He was ill. He had cancer, lo aleinu. He died of natural causes. The Nazis didn't kill him. He died in 1942. Mashu Kazeh, he was in the ghetto. He had to deal with all those questions of the Judenrat. Do you give the names of the sick Jews or the Jews who don't work to the a secret to the SS, to the Gestapo, lo aleinu? He had to deal with those questions. He died of Atmos Nefesh with the cancer. One son reached America, was a medical doctor. Son was not from. And I got a letter when that article appeared, a grandson who had become a Baal Tshuva. And he thanked me so for publishing about his Zayda. And I have that letter in my possession. It's probably in the office in my file on the Kovner Rav. So it's interesting the way life plays out. But you see, the Rav was saved from Hitler, came to America. Who wanted him in America? Plenty of Achmas Nefesh in America. And then, you know, again, the shuls ruled the rabbis. It's not Rakepit's plan that the Torah culture department of the Jewish agency is going to send the rabbis and pay the rabbis and rule the rabbis. No, in America, what he went through, and the kashrut, and the judge, A.K. Cohn, who did the investigation. I mean, it's an unbelievable story. And how they became very good friends, this reformed Jew, worship the ground the Rav walked on. He never saw someone so honest when he issued his decision. It's unbelievable. You can understand why the Rav loved America. And if I can quote Tova Lichtenstein to you, again, it was told this, as I'm quoting things said to me many decades ago, but she said it very succinctly. When my father became an American citizen, he gave a kiddush. When we went on Aliyah, we gave a kiddush. Listen to that sentence and think about it. My grandfather, David Fogel, family tradition has it that every year he added, if he owed taxes $1,000, he gave the American government $1,100 in Thanksgiving that he could become a contractor painter, have a little business and succeed in America, coming over penniless from Vilna. The fact that, and this was the attitude. My grandfather, who learned in Volozhin yet, he learned in Volozhin when it reopened, it's not the original year of Volozhin, but he learned in Volozhin, and when I told him that we're going in Aliyah, he said, my meaning is, my viewpoint is, that we have to think about it again, not to make such a hasty decision to go in Aliyah. Understand? So this was the Rav. He was totally at home in Western culture. Didn't replace Torah, didn't synthesize it with Torah. But when a kid doesn't want to go to college, the Rav said to him, Yafet Hamatorim Derech Eretz. He didn't quote Rav Hirsch and didn't go into a long pilpul. Bismanazer, at this moment in time, Derech Eretz is college. There was something else about the Rav, and this becomes critically important in modern times. And you see, we all worship the New York Times. That was the sign of Americanism. Reb Moshe Feinstein read the New York Times every day. Remember, Rav Volk used to occasionally call from the New York Times. Yes, Yomo, what's up? Go ahead, you wanted to add something.
No, I just saw New York Times published in the front page an article written by Naftali Bennett.
Yeah, today, New York
Times? Not today, the last few days.
Oh, very nice. What do you write about?
I don't know. I saw a photo.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. The New York Times. Huh? Mm-hmm. So you see the Naftali Bennett, the Bayit Yehudi, the Tsar of Chinuch here, the man that got a lot of votes from the greater Rakefet family. I think we gave him over 30 votes. Let's hope for the next election we can do even better, and he will do even better. Okay. Anyway. we live in a time where the Rebbeim, this concept of Das Torah, you all know I gave 6 months of lectures in the Kol on Das Torah. I consider those among my greatest lectures ever, my best lectures ever, Kanein Hara. The concept of Das Torah is a modern concept. It does not exist. The only time the word Das Torah is used in Shas is in Chulin, Daf Tzadi Bet, I believe it is Daf Tzadi Hey, the Sugya with Gid Hanasha, where it means Das Torah tradition says this is the halachat of Gid Hanasha. But in modern times, they turned Das Torah into a Chedah. I say it developed from the Hasidic world. Hasidim disagree with me, but I'm partially right. Hasidim say we worship the Rebbe, he's like our father. But I say there's also the concept, how can the Rebbe be wrong? If you go on the internet today, if you're quoting already the internet, Jomo, you go on to Olamam Shel Charedim, you'll see the description of the Vishnus Rebbe, Rebbe Yisrael, the shtick going on that the Gemara has his picture on the cover. I hold that to be Avodah Zarah. I hold that to be Asar Al Pi Din 100%. It's hard, but this is Chassidus, to worship the Rebbe Tanz, the Rebbe Es, the Rebbe Shlaf, and as the Rebbe Tanz, Dafim Tanz Nar Chassidus. So you have to follow the Rebbe, you have to follow whatever he tells you, and with Chassidic world, it's great. You never have to make decisions. They say, a chassid will ask the Rebbe what color car he should buy. If someone asks me what color car he should buy, I'd smack his face and tell him, don't waste my car with Narishkeit. What color car? So, but this Das Torah translated over, and you all know they're good at Yisrael. I've spoken about it. They go to Yisrael, 1919. Das Torah, the Rav, we spoke about the Choshen Mishpat, the Tzitz. Everything is Rabbonim Das Torah. Okay. When it comes to students, if you start with Das Torah, again, you are cloning students. It's no different than the Hasidic world. Hasidic world, everyone dresses alike, looks alike, to a great degree thinks alike. When the Rebbe tells you vote Agudat Yisrael, Ger owns Agudat Yisrael because Ger produces tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of votes for Agudat Yisrael. Without Ger, Agudat Yisrael would have a lot of problems. You put Ger, Bells, Vishnitz together, they vote en masse. You all understand in America the power Satmar has because they vote en masse. The Rav could not tolerate this. This troubled him. He spoke out against it time after time. Now, in his early years in America, the New York Times never mentioned anything about Orthodox Judaism. The attitude towards Orthodox Judaism, I quoted in the Silver Era, was it's a weed from Europe that will soon disappear. It has no relevance on the American scene. Fine. Conservative rabbi, a reform rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, it's going to languish. It's finished. It's rotten. It's ancient. No relevance. By the 1970s, Torah was making itself heard in the American scene. The Rav always credited Chabad, and there's a lot of truth to this, that more than any other segment or part of Torah Judaism, Chabad deserves the credit for working up the world. But by the 1970s, the New York Times was astute enough to know there's more to Judaism than Chabad. I still remember the reporter was a little Jewish guy. At every RCA convention, he was mixing and asking questions, and at Geret Abyssal Yiddish, you follow me, and right away, if someone spoke Yiddish to at an RCA convention, you opened up to him. He was a nice guy, I forget his name, but you can check it out. Go back to the 60s, the 70s. Anyway, by the 1970s, the New York Times comes to the Rav. And June 23rd, 1972, there's a classic interview with the Rav. You should know, after the Rav, they do Reb Moshe Feinstein in the New York Times. And I just want to quote to you from this interview. Earlier this week, Rabbi Soloveitchik received a visitor in his study in Brookline and in the living room of his daughter's home nearby, and gave some of the views of his views of present-day Judaism. He described himself as a shy person and denied that he was an authority in the usual sense of the word. I have many pupils, I have many disciples, but I never impose my views on anyone, he said. And you see, this is something we saw in the classroom day in and day out. The Rav, Gadol Hadar, who could learn like him? Who could give a shiur like him? Who could crystallize a Rambam like him? Never imposed his views on any student. And we saw that daily. Again, I'll tell you the story that made the biggest impression upon me, which I've spoken about many times. But he was very different. You see, the yeshiva world, the ultimate goal, the ultimate drive, the ultimate achievement, to clone myself to be like my Rebbe. Not with the Rav. And I'll never forget that this was a moment in time, the first shiur the Rav gave that I understood. It had to be, I write about it, maybe 55, 56, 55 I think it was. So he gave a shiur in Enos in Mitzvot Chavilot Chavilot. I believe it's written up in Sherilun, the Zeicha Abba Mari. And he dealt there with Kiddush, Haftalah. And he went into the whole concept of Haftalah. And in, with his Goynisha cup, he developed the idea that in Tul Havdalah, your table is a table of Kedusha, of Shabbos. You bring it in with Kiddush. The Kiddush you make elevates all the eating you're going to do for the next 25 hours is Kedushat HaShabbat. Then Havdalah completes that Kedusha, puts you back to Chol, the table returns to its normal profane activity. And the Rav developed the idea that it's very important for Havdalah to sit, the tablecloth shouldn't be removed yet, you don't take off the last vestige of Shabbos yet, that's only after you make Havdalah. Beautiful shiur developed, the Rambam, remember the Gemara in Psachim, Abbe Psachim, and a few weeks later, after the yard site, the Rav spent Shabbos in the neighborhood with his mother. And this was rare. Spent Shabbos, everyone knew the Rav was in the yeshiva. Obviously, they're not going to let him get away without speaking. Shabbos nach Mincha, after Mincha, the Rav gave a talk. And we walked from all over to come to the yeshiva. Many of us had money in the locker. We had lockers. We left money to go home after Shabbos. But we walked from all over. Washington Heights, but the Bronx. Remember, I've told you, many people think Washington Heights and the Bronx are one community. They're not that far wrong. At that time, there was the little Washington Bridge that within 5 minutes from the Bronx, you're in Washington Heights. And it was true, that whole area in the Bronx adjacent to Washington Heights was filled with Jews. It's not like today. And you had the feeling, I was a little further over, but all right, so it was a 40-minute walk, a 35-minute walk. And now, I remember, like it's happening this moment, we finished Maariv, we're in the Beis Medrash, the official Beis Medrash, and we're ready to make Havdalah. And the Gabbai who just died, Yisrael Reis, just died, I learned. He was a few years older than I am, 2 years older than I am. Yisrael ran the shul, and he was from a Yekesha family. Do you know the family? Reis, Washington Heights. And do you know the family, Yomo? Are they still Yekes or America? They're still Yekes. All right, good to hear. All right, I'm good, glad to hear. So Yisrael comes over to the Rav. Rebbe, you'll make Havdalah for us? So what could the Rav say? So the Rav, fine. So resets up all the equipment in front of the Rav, and everyone sits down. Hundreds of people, like automatically. And the Rav says, Vetach Megalazine, the Sidus, what? Huri Vasva Malach, who told you the secrets? How come everyone is sitting? And they said, Rebbe, you just gave a shiur. You told us what to do. You told us what you do. You just gave a shiur. That was so revealing. A few weeks after the shiur, where the Rav convinced everyone, he's asking, what are you sitting for? He was, he could never realize who he was, how the students related to him. He could never feel, when someone came over to him, with all the lumdis, I don't have to tell you, kiddush you have to sit, kviyat sutta. It's a whole shaila whether you stand or not for vayichulu ashmayim v'aretz. All right, we stand because it's eidut. So you all know the Mishnah Paskal, you stand for the front, then you sit down for the bracha, kviyat sutta, and everyone. So a kid will come over to the Rav of Taisvus, Nabi Pesachim already raises the issue. A kid will come over and say, Rebbe, you know, I come from a Hasidic background. My parents stand for Kiddush. What should I do? You do what your father says. What's the question? Follow the Rav gave a shiur entirely different. And this kid is asking him. A Hasidic Rebbe would never answer that way. Does the Rav say? You're a chassid, you got to do what the Rebbe does. The Rav, like he said to the New York Times, was, I have many pupils, I have many disciples, but I never impose my views on anyone. So I think my Talmidim who are listening, who have studied with me, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, you can now understand your Rebbe a little bit better. I could never clone a student. I'm the happiest person in the world to see different types of students. And over the years, I've met students. There's a fellow who's a prominent Chabad lawyer in Crown Heights. Comes from Detroit. And I think I told you, I met him in Los Angeles a number of years ago. Oh, he was there doing business for Chabad. He embraced me, he hugged me, and he said, Rebbe, you don't know what a debt I owe you. He said, you remember my inclinations? I said, of course, you showed me letters from the Rebbe when you were my student in BMT. He said, you were the only one on the faculty who encouraged me to continue a relationship with Chabad. You follow? And they go, what am I, a kid is interested in Chabad? Was is schlecht? What is so bad? What is so bad? And I've had students, I can mention a name, Chaim Ilson. So people don't understand when Chaim Ilson meets me, we hug, we embrace, they don't understand our relationship. He's my Talmud. He's the only kid I ever kicked out of my class. I went to Mr. Abrams and I said, Mr. Abrams, I have one student who is brilliant. There's a Goynish Cup. And I cannot teach, if I teach to his level, the other 24 kids will not understand the word. Push him up. And Mr. Abrams said to me, I'll never forget it, Arnold, are you sure you want to lose him? He's a very good student. You say he has a good mind. I say, for his good, kick him up. He went from my class to another Rebbe. From that Rebbe, he went to the Rav. You follow? And that's the famous Rabbi Chaim Olson. It's my student. Aye, he's not a YU product today in the sense he doesn't go around. He's not going to tell a kid who doesn't want to go to college, Yafet Kamatorim Derecheretz, will say to the kid, thank God you woke up and you don't want to go to college. But, freedom of choice, individuality. And this was a basic message that the Rav conveyed essentially in the classroom. I remember we used to bother Rebbe. This, we had a kid who was in medical school, a Kohen. His father was a Rav. I can get in much more details, but it's not important. I don't want to embarrass anyone. And I remember we're going to Rebbe. Rebbe, say something to this kid. He's in medical school. He's a Kohen. I remember the Rebbe said, his father is a Rav. His father is a Talmud Chacham. I'm certainly spoke with his father. I can't mix him. And the Rav refused, plain and simple. And this was a critical issue. I'll never forget when in the 50s, from Poli Agudat Yisrael, Poli Agudat Yisrael doesn't exist today, but Poli Agudat Yisrael was, I personally would feel very at home in Poli Agudat Yisrael, if you read me. It was really frum, and they were part of the Israeli scene, and they were open to the big world. It doesn't exist today because the world became the chasm that exists today. Either you're Mizrahi or Aguda, there's like no middle road between them. Poli Agudat Yisrael was a synthesis, let me use that word, between the Mizrahi and the Aguda. And it's a sad story. It doesn't exist today. There was a lot of aggravation. Binyamin Mintz died with aggravation when the Gever Rebbe refused to see him. He was a chassid and they had broken and he, Poli Agudat. So Poli Agudat at one time, they were dealing with people in Switzerland to come up with plastic bodies for doctors to practice on. So I remember we're talking with the rabbi, and this was earth-shaking, a plastic body with a heart, with lungs, with kidneys, with veins, with arteries, and sounds good, right or wrong, do a real job. And the doctors would solve all problems of Kohanim. And the Rav said, would you like a doctor to operate on you whose only experience with a lung and a heart and a kidney was a plastic imitation? You see, you with me, Morty? See, that's the Rav. See, that story, you capture the heart of the Rav. And this was the Rav. This was the Rav. Now, I want to say something else about the Rav. Go in. I won't finish it today. We'll move further on Sunday. Sunday I have a big surprise. When I lend off the Rav, big surprise. Something else. Kavod HaTorah. You know, we were American kids. American kids, the concept of cover doesn't really exist. I grew up, I never had the feeling of awe for my parents. Whether that's right or wrong, but that's the reality. I don't think my children ever had a feeling of awe for their father and mother. You know, it's father, mother. The Rav, you knew who he was. You know, there are no two ways about it. The man was a gaon adir, the man's knowledge. You knew his yichus. How many of you, I boast that I'm sitting in a room, I'm the only one here who spoke in learning with the Rav, with the Baron Cutler, with Joseph Elio Henkin. I'm boasting. Now I can boast my yichus. I'm a blood relative of Rabbi Revel. It's big, big yichus. The Rav, everyone knew this. Rabbi Chaim Zaneinikel, Rabbi Moshe's son. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's first cousin, once removed. The Yahrzeit Shir, in memory of his father, that was the high point of the Torah year in America. It was something else. If you looked into the shurm he gave, the depth, the chiddush, I did some of them in the Kollel in the 80s, early 80s. And after the halacha, the Agada, how can a person give a shiur 4.5 hours? I just spoke with New York. I told you at the start of the shiur. So I told them, I have to sit. I can't. A long shiur, what are we talking? They tell me, well, this shiur, you'll have 45 minutes. Ah, when people tell me 45 minutes, it means an hour. Give me an hour. But What do I talk? All right. And even, you say, well, you're an old man. All right, I'm an old man. Fine. But even 20, 30 years ago, the Rav had that ability. I still remember the Yahrzeit Shrimp. There's a picture in Washington. The picture I discovered when after my mother died and we cleaned out the house. That's the best picture of the Rav giving a shiur. No picture equals it. Look at the picture in Washington. In the Beis Medrash, it's 55, I believe. I dated it there, 55. You'll see the date. He was standing 4 hours, 4.5 hours. Oh. And he had the shtick. He was an actor, you know that. You all know, Reb Heschel writes about it. I write about it. We were both there, right up front, when he finished the Yahrzeit shiur. So some rabbi from Brooklyn comes up to him. The Rav is tired now. It's the 60s. He's finished 4 hours, 4.5. Rabbi Soloveitchik, du bist a greiser Aktor. You're a great actor. And the Rav on the spot answers, acting 90% from Zayna Malamed, 90% of being a teacher. Wow. Yeah, 90%. The Rav answered him on the spot. So the crowd that came, and you had there from Lakewood, from Chaim Berlin, from Torah Vadas. There was not yet a big Hasidic presence. There was Chabadnikim in there. The crowd that came mesmerized. That you saw Kavod HaTorah. You had to experience it. You walked out, it was like Maimed Har Sinai. Once a year we all experienced the admiration and reverence in which the Rav was held by the greater Yeshiva University community. The night that the Rav delivered his annual halachic and agadic discourse on the anniversary of his father's death was always a unique appearance. And then I go on to describe, and here's where I feel so bad, but that's life. And I'll end off with this. A mob scene came. You wanted to get a good seat. The drasha began at 8 o'clock at night. Charlie, were you ever at one of these outside drashas? What were you doing in high school? Physics? The truth. Torah derech eretz. Okay. No complaints. Anyone ever had a Yahrzeit Rasha here? No? Okay. Aryeh's grandfather was there, Rabbi Bums, that I can tell you. And you wanted to get a good seat. So, 8 o'clock, 8:30, 9 o'clock, 11 hours before the shiur began, people went into the auditorium. You left your hat in the seat. You left your Gemara. You left your pen and your notebook. You left the sign, your name on it. Hundreds and hundreds of seats were reserved by 10 a.m. And my greatest regret, I should have come into the Beis Medrash and taken a picture. That picture you would call Kavod HaTorah. But the problem was, we're only human. And when you're a kid, when you're 20, when you're 30, even when you're 40, you think you're going to live forever. We couldn't envision a world without the Yahrzeit Shiur, without the Rav. Nothing will change. My father used to have an expression, if only we could make time stand still. He was surrounded by children, by grandchildren, my children, his grandchildren. It's a moment in time. If only we could make time stand still. Unfortunately, we can't. And years ago, when I was a star in the Kollel, today I'm a nonentity, but whatever the reasons are, years ago. So I told this story to the Kollel. And before Purim, I think it is, the picture is hanging in my office. They went and set up the room awaiting my shiur. Every desk, every chair had a notebook open, a gemara, a hat, a reservation, and they signed the picture, the Kavod HaTorah, to our Rebbe, and everyone in that class signed that particular picture. It hangs in my office. But the Yardside Shir was the high point, the ultimate, the teacher, the ability, the insight, the depth. And then the sad part, that the Rav was a perfectionist. He had inherited Reb Chaim's trait. The Briska were always frightened that they hadn't hit the ultimate truth. And they credit Reb Chaim with saying that everything you think, do you say? Not everything you say, do you write up? That everything you write up, do you publish? And the Rav never published anything in Shas and Paiskim. The Yardside Shigurim, even the little bit has been published, doesn't do justice. They have the halacha, they don't have the agata. They lose the continuity. They don't date it. That's also important. Halavai, the master, would have published, given his notes, have they edited, written up, published what we have lost. But this is brisk. There's nothing you can do. So you say, how would the She'erim L'Zeich Abba Murray finally published? Yeah, sure, they were finally published when the Rav was no longer functioning in the 80s. And his son-in-law put together from the manuscripts that survived. That's how we have the two volumes She'erim L'Zeich Abba Murray. But coming from the hands of the master, the way he actually gave it, that we are lacking. That we do not have. And that too is a result of human frailty. Those of you who study Chumash on a level and have studied with Reb David Zvi Hoffman, I always say when someone asks me a question in Chumash, I say that you have to ask a woman, not a man. The graduates of the Upanot, of Michala, Dor, they know Chumash with Mefarshim. So if you've ever studied with Reb David Zvi Hoffman, you recognize the name, right? Reb David Zvi Hoffman was the head of Hildesheimer. He died, I believe it was 1921, and he was a Hungarian who knew, he was like Reb Chaim Heller. He knew Kol HaTorah Kula and languages, Torim Derech Eretz in the ultimate sense of the word. So his Perush to Vayikra Devarim, the most difficult Sforim in Chumash, he published B'chayav. They're on a tremendous level. Later they found Kitvei Yad, that his lectures on Bereshit, Shmot, that also was published. Vamidba, I don't know if all three, but at least two of the three were published. It's not on the same level. It was not the master's hand who gave it out. But that's human frailty. We have to live with it. But with the Rav, the Briska concept is responsible. So I will say he published in philosophy in his lifetime. That only strengthens Rakefet's thesis. Because in philosophy you can't be wrong. You follow? They get very points of view. You can't be right, you can't be wrong. It's not Shtvah Hashem Zu Halacha. In Shas and Paiskim, you have to reach a conclusion. You have to paskin. And the Ribbono Shel Olam has to paskin like you. Lo b'shamayim, the Gemara in Baba Metzia, Tanur d'Achnayi, the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah on the new moon. But philosophy, all right, Leila, Ish Halacha, the lonely man of faith, Adam 1, Adam 2, Kol Dodi Dofek, the Sheif Tfikat, you can't be wrong. Beautiful. My dear friends, thank you for coming and enabling the Rebbe. That's what I said to Ribbono Shel Olam twice. I don't want to say it a third time. Twice I found myself on the floor recently, and each time I didn't emulate Reb Aaron Kotler when the Jordanians were shooting at the wedding in the 50s, yeah, 53, 54, could be. So so he jumped under the table and he said, Rebbein Shalom, Rechtaf Mel Lerinin, I have more to learn. Remember I told you about this when I spoke about Reb Aaron? And unfortunately, I'm not on his level. I think I know already. I got to smack my face. I said, Rebbein Shalom, I have more to teach. I have more to give. I have to get it out of my system. Have mercy. Have mercy. Gentlemen, what did we do today? We haven't finished the Rav. We're going to have a very interesting final thought, but I have a little bit more to do next week. Will I use these lectures as a basis for what I want to do in New York? Yeah, part of it. I want to deal with the life. I want to deal with Agudat Mizrachi. But then I have to give a drasha. I'm going to deal with Vayakhil Pekudei, Dafka, the worst sedrot for a Rav to preach on. For me, it's the best for what I want to say about the Torah, building Torah, etc. And then they want me to speak on the Haggadah. It's a farce. They want me to speak on the Rav, but they're calling it a pre-Pesach, a Midrashia, Yom Rishon. So I'm going to tie in the Rav's gestalt with the Haggadah. That is not difficult, Be'ezrat Hashem, but I didn't do it here. And then I want to deal with the Rav outside of the classroom as a human being, part of what I did here, put it together. So what did we do today? We spoke about the Rav as a Rebbe, the basic gestalt of the Rav, the understanding of yeshiva, yeshiva college, yeshiva university. That's overwhelming. I only touched it. If you open up the Rav, the World of, Volume 2, go through the whole description the Rav is of German Orthodoxy and where he differs. It's very powerful, but all right, it's not that germane to the point I wanted to make. And the Rav with the whole concept of cloning students, and of course the Yotzeit Shia. All right, I hope I've to a certain degree brought Rebbe to life. So next week we continue, everything is normal. Now, for those who weren't here yesterday, but will hear the shir, here is the what I gave out, and that's when the letter of the Rebbe was sent to me, that was typed up here. That I interpreted the letter and the Rav's handwriting. I was able to put it together. If anyone didn't take it yesterday, you're welcome to take it today. A lot of freebies. Here is a very interesting article from the New York Times, how Arafat eluded Israel's assassination machine, and it deals with the unbelievable problem that the Mossad faced. They thought Arafat was on a plane, and Sharon gave the order to shoot the plane down, which would have meant killing endless innocent people on the plane just to kill Arafat. It turned out it was not Arafat in the plane, it was his brother. And a minute before the operation was to go into effect, it was called off. And it's a true article. The Israeli press has picked it up as well. This is very interesting. This is Rabbi Riskin, who's creating a lot of headlines all over the world. This is what Rabbi Rubin referred to, women as spiritual leaders and halachic decisors. It's Rabbi Riskin, a whole, I would call it a kitzur Shulchan Aruch on what he thinks on these topics. I can tell you I don't agree with a good part of it, but if you want to see his thinking, it's there. Here's Rabbi Riskin, which is being criticized all over the world right now. He calls for public transportation on Shabbat, and the drivers should be non-Jewish Arabs. It's a terrible proposal. The Rav shot him down when he made the same proposal in the 70s. You probably don't remember it, but I remember it well, that people living in suburbia have a bus pick them up for shul with non-Jewish drivers. The Rav shot him down. There's no one here today to shoot him down. If anyone's interested, that's the proposal. Cincinnati celebrates 50 at the yard site of Rabbi Eliezer Silva, Agudat Israel in Cincinnati. Very interesting. I can only make one comment. Are they that intellectually honest to tell you that the Silva already became persona non grata as Agudim more and more to the right? I'm happy to see they recognize him today. Here's an interesting question that came my way. Again, with Rabbi Eliezer Silva, that they say when he visited Europe right after World War II, he went into the convents, into the churches, and said Shema Yisrael, and the kids repeated Shema Yisrael, we knew we're Jews. So people ask me why I don't mention the Silvir. I never found sources for it. It's absolutely true about Rav Herzog, but Rav Herzog went later than Rav Silva. From all I can gather, from all my research, Rav Silva went right afterwards into the DP camps, and his goal was to help the survivors. I don't think they were sophisticated enough yet to know what was going on in the churches. So I didn't want to mention it because I don't have a source. So people here equate the two, but I don't know whether it's accurate from the point of view of scholarship. We don't get out of the terrible problem of child abuse, and here it's unbelievable. The Baltimore's Orthodox community turn a blind eye to child sexual abuse. What's amazing here, this is the Orthodox shul in Baltimore that is the closest to Chovevei Torah. It's the one shul in Baltimore that is not really part of the general Baltimore scene. And here there's a whole story, I can't believe my eyes, what people are suspected of. New York Times, again, with the present Pope, he's getting into a lot of trouble, apologizes to abuse victims, but he then adapts them. In other words, this is the whole problem with Me Too. Is it true? Now they got Woody Allen is being censured all over the place, which doesn't surprise me, because someone who throws away color Torah Kula, Numela, but he married to his own daughter, right or wrong, the adopted daughter. Ay, God, that's hard to talk about it. But the Pope has a problem. He's censuring, and on the other hand, he doesn't really believe them. This is very interesting. The Yonkers Shul, these people who converted to Judaism, who are from, but are not Caucasian. They are Latinos. And the old timers in the shul are not happy with them. They're taking over the shul. The neighborhood is changing, and they're the ones who are davening there. Very interesting article. Legends of Jewish Music Remembered. The people who wrote the Goldfarb, Shalom Aleichem, the tune that we all sing, Shalom Aleichem, or the people who wrote the benching, the Hazon et Olam Kulo Bituvo, and it's they're calling them, remembering them. And finally, very interesting article that the New York State, they're starting to fund for children all types of high-tech projects. And it seems the day schools, the parochial schools, will also be funded, because this is not for the school, it's for the child to develop high-tech techniques and make Rav Kefet look older and older. My dear students, until we meet again next Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem, in health and happiness, Das Vidanya.